Okay, we are on the record. April 22nd, statutory interpretation, regulatory practice class. We are in the last lap of our discussion on agency practice. And in particular, we've been drilling down very specifically on a narrow but important band of agency actions, namely how agencies interpret statutes and to what extent courts should defer to those agency interpretations. Remember we talked about on Wednesday, sorry, Travis, now you got me completely wrapped around the axle. On Monday, we talked about the Meade decision and how it interplayed with Chevron and Skidmore. So with that in mind, just to sort of make sure, this is probably pretty important stuff to make sure we have pretty clear. This should all be rote repetition for you by this point. But what are the two steps of Chevron? Any volunteers? You're wearing a tie. This is a little intimidating.
Step one is look. Well, do you want to start with step zero or?
No, let's start. Just keep it simple. We'll expand out.
Look at Congress. If Congress addressed the issue directly, then you have other than have express delegation of authority implied. And then you have, and step two is Congress.
All right, slow down a little bit. I can't write quite that fast. And you said it can be either express or it can be implied. Why does that matter?
Because express delegations of authority, standard of view is arbitrary and capricious.
Okay.
And for implied, it's just reasonable.
All right. Then what was step two?
Congress did not address it.
And can you elaborate a little bit on what reasonable means? Oh, come on. Remember, if you have a range, a gray zone of possible answers, the agency can pick in that range. And the court must defer, even if it might have preferred a different answer within that range. But the agency gets to make that call as long as it's reasonable within that range. Okay, so this is step one, step two. Now I'm throwing the field open. Does anyone have any suggested revisions or changes to step one and step two, or is this the perfect crystallization for your final exam of what you need to know on Chevron? All right, we're all clear? Gosh, well then that was almost too easy. So B, I'm passing the throne to now, Jack, here you go. He gets the Chevron cigar for this week. Now, last chance. Any other further revisions to step one and two? Okay. Now we're up then to, I heard you say, step zero. Anyone else want to take a shot on what step, Jordan?
You look and see if Congress delegated authority to the agency to issue interpretations that carry the force of the law. There's kind of generally not, of course, the specific question at issue at this point. And then you see if the agency has exercised that authority.
Sorry, could you go a little too fast, right? So to delegate the authority to the agency to
issue interpretations that carries the force of the law.
All right.
And then you ask if the agency has exercised that authority.
All right. Anything else?
If yes, you go to the Chevron step one, and if no,
so, if it's yes, Chevron, if it's no, Skidmore. All right, without talking about what Skidmore is just yet. Does this sort of capture step zero? And just to make sure we're all keeping our case names straight in our heads, which case is step zero? Everyone said it together. That's so encouraging for me. They said it quietly in a murmur, but I'll take that. This is Meade, step zero here. Okay. Everybody, this is our look back review. So I figured rather than just talking about the case that we talked about, this would be more useful to everybody based on the questions I got yesterday. So have we now crystallized step zero? Me, is this the perfect, Anika?
I think he said in general, so I think that's an important.
You're absolutely correct. Anything else? You said that he said that, though. So, George, my apologies for not writing quite quickly now. Anything else? All right. You sure? Okay. I didn't have a cigar. I had to think of something that would make you think of me. This is me. I had to actually find this stuff. There's actually honeyed wine. They actually sell it with mulling spices. Having said that, the guys at the store told me that it had a 92 wine rating. But at the same time, I don't think I would drink it. But here you go. All right. By the way, I probably should have turned off the recorder. We're all over about silence. I'm not allowed to get alcohol out of class. So let's just call that instead a recreational beverage. Sorry, what? It's honey that sort of makes it non-alcoholic. Okay, I'll take that. Okay. And by the way, just to lower the expectations here, I tried, but I could not think of anything for Skidmore. I thought about the best of Skid Row, but that just wasn't quite good enough. So, you know, chocolate skillets, nothing. I'm sorry. So, fortunately, this is just for the sheer intellectual pleasure of understanding this down to its bones. If we, at the decision box here, have to go, no, Mead says that there's no Chevron deference here, what is Skidmore? Who wants to take a shot at describing Skidmore? James?
No, it's a fourth factor test, or it's the kind of sliding test. And you defer it based on the thoroughness of the agency's investigation.
Defer if?
Based on the thoroughness of the agency's investigation.
All right, is that one of the factors? Yeah. So rather than write all four, do you mind if I sort of cheated a little bit? Just said, you know, if four factors, but what do those four factors really boil down to?
I mean, it's a sliding test. I don't know how to distill down the four factors.
You catch it there. It's a sliding case-specific test.
Yeah.
And the test weighs whether or not, I'm fighting my inclination to finish it for you. So.
You balance the validity versus the consistency of interpretation of time. And then the persuasive power of the agency. So yeah, you're balancing. You can probably say it better. I just don't version. I just know the four factors, not kind of.
But your three-year mission is to walk out here saying it better than I can say it. But I think you're circling the concept, and I think I'll open it up for everyone as well. These four factors are not from a statute. They're not drawn from any black-letter constitutional principles. There are rules of thumb on essentially how credible, how worthwhile is that agency interpretation. See, I gave in.
Yeah.
Sorry, James. So as a result, it essentially uses the specific circumstances of how the agency's decision was made to determine how much respect the decision is due. So as a result, as opposed to Chevron, which strives for some sense of analytical clarity, some bright line. Skidmore is more of a, we'll take each one as it comes in approach. So I'll pause here. Does that sort of ring true for you now? Does it have a vibe? You hear the rhythm now. All right. Any questions about it so far? Okay. Then, very briefly, just to remind everyone, the cases we actually talked about, and Brian, just to sort of let you know, we're on a slow arc towards you since you had to finish up from last. We talked about examples of how these cases, how these principles actually play out. Gonzales versus Oregon, the Death with Dignity Act in Oregon. That case focused on to what extent Attorney General Ashcroft was empowered by Congress to issue an interpretation of a DOJ rule that essentially said any physician who is prescribes controlled substance drugs to let a patient kill themselves is automatically acting against the public interest and is therefore going to be deregistered and barred from prescribing drugs. That was a Mead analysis. It was a step zero determination. The court looked at whether or not the structure of the Controlled Substance Act and the way it divided authority between the Attorney General and the Department of Health and Human Services and determined that Congress did not mean to give the Attorney General plenary authority to determine what was an appropriate medical decision. And since Congress did not mean to give that power to the Attorney General, the Attorney General's interpretation and application of that regulation was not merited due deference under Chevron. That hopefully that reflects what you guys took away from that case too. Any questions about that? Because it also had an Easter egg built into it. Remember? It talked about our, A-U-E-R, and whether or not there's even more deference when DOJ is interpreting its own regulations. And I said, save that one. We'll come back to it. Today we come back to it. So that was Gonzales versus Oregon. And it was an entertaining decision. Remember, we also had Justice Scalia's vigorous dissent talking about how those principles apply. So with that in mind, what I'd like to do is sort of jump ahead and talk now a little bit about where this takes us. Remember, I ended class on Monday giving you some questions to think about. Things about where Chevron may extend or where it may not make sense. Does it make sense to extend Chevron to criminal statutes? The way agencies interpret criminal statutes. Does it make sense for Chevron to be extended to interpretations of the agency's own jurisdiction? We'll talk about that today. Does it make sense to extend it in areas where there's a strong federalism concern? Chevron introduces a sense of clarity, but when you actually write it off to the hinterlands where there's some real deep structural conflicts of deep values, it starts to bend. So with that in mind, what I'd like to do then is talk about one of those questions to start, and namely, what deference does an agency get if it's interpreting a statute's provisions on what powers it has? Does an agency get deference in determining the scope of its own authority? Now, I'll simply pause here and just ask the obvious question for anyone here. Brian, you can jump in on this one, but it's open for anybody. Why wouldn't you? What is the drawback of letting an agency look at a statute that empowers it to act and interpreting that statute to flesh out the scope, the full range of its powers? What's the downside? More nakedly, what are people scared of? What are they worried about? So essentially, the agency will overreach.
Yes.
Okay, and you're exactly right. The way that typically gets labeled is bootstrapping. The agency will take a granted power, and if they have the additional shield of deference, they'll stretch that power as far as they possibly can. And the assumption here is that every agency will have the motive to do that. Just the natural agency imperative is to extend the reach of its power. So why would a court give deference to a self-serving agency interpretation that gives it power? Believe it or not, that was the question in our last case on Monday. Blah. I will get the date straight, I promise. So Brian, could you talk a little bit then about the City of Arlington versus FCC? Which was it? It was, I mean, a little tucked away case at the end of our reading, but it touches on some interesting issues.
So there's a Communications Act of 1934 that was passed regulating electronic communications, and the FCC basically could prescribe such rules, or to quote, prescribe such rules and regulations as may be necessary to or necessary in the public interest to carry out its provisions. And then they even further narrowed it in 1996, saying that they have to, that they're requiring state or local governments to act on wireless siting applications within a reasonable period of time after the request is filed. And then even further, they narrowed it down in 2009, issuing a rule that the reasonable period of time that they're referring to in the last statute is, I think it was 90 days to process an application, and then 150 days to process all their other applications. So
before you go forward, I need to do a quick check. So who's still awake on this side of class? Okay. Let's find the pulse in this case.
Okay. Yeah. I just
no. You're doing the backdrop, but you know there actually is something here that affects all of us. So what was the specific thing that the states were dragging their feet on?
I jumped straight to the issue on that, but I think that, the state and local governments really didn't like that they were being told, I guess, necessarily when a reasonable amount of time is. They said that the FCC has no authority to narrow that time even further.
That's true. That was the legal point. The thing they were fighting, that they were being, the reason, the things that they were refusing to sign on it's in the factual description, very small and tucked away, but it's a very specific thing. And my pause, maybe I'm just relying on this, my subconscious is dredging this up and the book doesn't include it, in which case I really owe you a huge apology. Wireless towers. Wireless towers. How many of us have driven along the highways and seen giant antennas? Essentially, all those giant antennas are licensed by the FCC. They can't be built unless the FCC and the states approve it. And I'll tell you from personal experience, people hate cell towers. There is one company that has actually made a multi-million-dollar portfolio out of the simple expedient of building cell towers in disguise. They look like trees. They look like office buildings because people hate them so much. States were sensitive to that and basically were not issuing these licenses to hold them up. So FCC said, 90 days. And now we, hopefully you guys know that it's like a small jolt of caffeine. You have a sense of what's going on here. What's the legal issue?
Okay, so state and local governments obviously didn't like that. So they referred to the section that was, the section that shall limit or affect the authority of the state or local government over siting decisions. They challenged that and said that section wasn't authorized, basically, that was, I guess, too far of reach into, they used the word jurisdiction on that, and I got kind of confusing, and the whole thing was about that, but the original issue was a little confusing to me, but I think I just quoted a person who believes the state or local government's wireless siting decision to be inconsistent with any of the limitations in that statute. They were authorized by that statute to commence an action in any court of competent jurisdiction, and that was the issue that the Ninth Circuit then basically said that they were delegated that lawmaking authority and then therefore give it Chevron deference, and they use the reasonableness of its rule to basically that jurisdiction. But I mean, that the whole idea was that jurisdiction and the authority, there was no difference between jurisdiction and authority, basically, between what was given to
I'm sorry, that's the Ninth Circuit said, or now you
that's what the Supreme Court
said. Yeah, so the Ninth Circuit,
just gave it Chevron deference and said that's up to them.
Right, so that's the scenery we left to the stage. Now, Justice Scalia stepped up to the mic.
Yeah, so he comes in and he says, basically, there's no difference between jurisdiction or authority given to any sort of agency in the statute. And then he gave a very interesting example of, actually, them seen that before, where they could just give an example of a whole made-up statute. But he basically, he formulates a whole theoretical statute basically to demonstrate that there was no difference between authority and jurisdiction. Basically, they're the same thing, and it was unnecessary. He calls it acrobatics, or mental acrobatics, needed to decide whether an agency's interpretation of statutory provision was jurisdictional or non-jurisdictional. Mm-hmm. It was basically just another group that they had to jump through, and he didn't think that that was necessary. And I think it was, yeah, it was a pretty... I thought it was interesting also that it was him and Ginsburg and Sotomayor and Kagan.
Yeah, it's a bit of an odd majority, isn't it? But I, you know, if it will help in terms of the made-up statute, I have to confess, I read that and I thought, yeah, there are times you can tell Justice Scalia was a Harvard Law professor. I get to see him writing it up on the whiteboard for everyone to talk through. So it sounds like then the majority struck you, the fact that he uses hypothetical statute. In terms of his rationale, the fact that you can't reasonably and analytically distinguish between jurisdictional determinations by an agency as opposed to just its interpretation of substantive regulation. Was that persuasive?
Well, yeah, to me it was. I mean, I, especially when he demonstrated between the sections, I mean, essentially he said it was basically whether statutory text foreclosed the agency's assertion of authority. I mean, you could say did the agency overstep its jurisdiction or overstep its authority. I mean, I kind of feel like that's saying the same thing. I agree with him, I feel like that's saying the same thing. I mean, you could say that they don't have jurisdiction here to that. I can't remember exactly how he worded it, but it was convincing to me personally.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, and certainly I'll offer two thoughts, and you and I can sort of kick it around, and the rest of the class can join in. In a way, it is surprising Scalia wrote this opinion, but in a way it isn't. Because when you look at me, when you look at some of his other writings, in regulatory deference issues, as opposed to statutory interpretation, where he has a very clear, very sort of specific, arguably narrow viewpoint, for regulatory deference, he seems to be more in favor of the idea that it needs to be simple. Chevron is fine for Scalia, as long as Chevron is all you have to worry about. And putting in step zeros and trap doors and specific exclusions for him is gilding the lily. Either Chevron or it isn't. So from that perspective, drawing a line between jurisdictional and non-jurisdictional, yeah, that's just, it's a pain. And analytically, arguably, it's hard to make a distinction. But you know, going back to Shonda's comment earlier, is there a risk if an agency is pushing the boundaries on its jurisdictional grant in Congress by interpreting the deference?
Well, that's, I think the dissent was addressing that kind of. I mean, they, I think it was Chief Justice Roberts, he pretty much said that really if you're going to defer that much, I mean, you really, I mean, it's a little extreme, but I mean, he said you're really questioning the judicial role based on Marbury versus Madison when it was granted judicial review. Basically saying you're really stripping away that review that should be there, I guess, he thinks, at all times, I guess.
Yeah.
Which, but I guess that's like, I mean, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. It's pretty extreme, but...
Well, let me ask you the question then that might be a little unfair. I hope not. Hopefully it'd be good grist for a future law review note to decide the right one. What about Chief Justice Roberts' point writ large? That Marbury is an inherent power of the judiciary and that the court should not yield it to agencies in terms of interpreting jurisdiction. Doesn't that exact same argument apply for anything that's under Chevron? Why doesn't Marbury apply from the get-go? Why are you deferring to an agency if the courts have Article III judicial review power?
I guess that goes back to some of the same arguments where you don't necessarily want a bunch of judges dealing with specialties that agencies are informed on. So, I mean, because in my mind, it reverts back to that. I mean, you don't want them deciding about things that they have no idea. I mean, even if they do have judicial review, it doesn't necessarily mean they have specialization in everything.
True, but that's a policy argument.
Yeah. But...
Well, no, although it could be recast as a judicial legal argument. as I'm sure you guys remember from CIPRO and con law, courts withhold the exercise of power they have all the time on prudential grounds. It may be an issue that they don't want to address, or they feel that this is one that they'd be better to go to another decided body first. Having said that, and here, everyone, please lift your fingers off the keyboard because it's personal opinion, but just wanted to remind everybody, Chevron's been around a long time. Chevron has got an enormous accretion of precedents and in application in cases. But don't forget, Chevron is not holy writ. There is growing discussion about to what extent Chevron really makes sense. Especially when you hold it up against Skidmore. What are you getting with Chevron that you can't theoretically get with Skidmore anyway? And that's a fairly big question. Now, the reason I asked you not to type it is I don't want people to start to need to incorporate that into your analysis right now over the next couple of weeks. But over a longer arc of history, the trend has been for this question to be asked more and more. And it may help you sort of think about Chevron perhaps a little bit more skeptical life, which is arguably a good thing. It's easy to sort of take Chevron, tuck it in your arm, and march out, because it is that useful, it is that important. But it's not invulnerable. So right, now you can start typing again, point of personal privilege done. Okay, so anything else you'd like to add? Because this is, you know, the tail end of Monday, and we've got a lot to cover today. I think we kind of captured the key thing, which is Scalia said, pshaw. There is no reason to treat an agency jurisdictional interpretation differently than any other interpretation. You can't really draw a line anyway. Chief Justice Roberts says, wait, but in dissent. All right, anything else before we move along? Because that was question number one. Should agencies get deference in interpreting the scope of their own powers when they look at a statute? Short answer appears to be currently no. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes! Glad I caught that one fast. So what about the next question? This one's a little bit slightly different. It sort of emphasizes the fact that we've been looking at Model T, but an inch wide. Chevron deals with a very specific configuration. An agency looking at a statute that is within its jurisdiction to implement. That is not the situation when an agency is not looking at a statute, but instead looking at its own regulations. Now we've come to the hour question that I previewed on Monday. Chevron, theoretically, by its own terms, doesn't apply. Now, having said that, I think we all know the punchline here. Currently, there is a doctrine saying that when the agency interprets its own regulations, the courts not only give it Chevron deference, they give it super deference. More than they would if the agency is interpreting a statute. Let me pause a moment. And I just have to ask. This is one you don't even have to read a single case for. You could ask any person on the street, why? Why does that make sense? Why would the Supreme Court of the United States, in multiple decisions, uphold the idea that agencies get super deference when they look at and interpreting their own regulation? James has his hand up first. I wish I had another follow-up meeting.
No one has any better idea of the agency's regulation than the agency does, because it was promulgated completely and entirely within the agency itself.
Okay. So familiarity and expertise. Okay. That's one. Anything else besides that?
Well, having every interpretation open to question opens them all to judicial review.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. You tailed off the very end.
Sorry. Judicial review.
Why is that a bad thing? If I'm a judge, I kind of think that sounds kind of cool.
Because every person who, I guess, violates an agency regulation then has even more grounds to challenge it than they would if they accepted the agency interpretation.
Okay. So administrative, I would say efficiency is probably the word you're thinking of.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Efficiency, as well as familiarity and expertise, anything else? Because these are not sounding terribly legal. They sound practical.
Democratic values, because they're appointed by the president.
Why is that super deference? Why doesn't Chevron cover that?
That's a great question.
No, I mean, because that is one basis for Chevron. You're exactly right.
Well, I mean, it's just, there's similar policy reasons that we use in Chevron, it seems like. So the same, it seems like the same question.
Well, if you draw the short straw, then it leads inevitably to the next question. Why our deference? Why not just Chevron deference?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure.
Well, that's not an answer, though.
Well, that's kind of my question. You turn it back around with me.
Well, that's what law professors do. It's actually one of the most fun parts of their job. Anyone else would like to take a shot as to why? I think those three arguments so far, pro-democratic values, efficiency, and agency expertise and familiarity, all perfectly valid policy reasons for doing this. It doesn't answer the question of why then you take the extra layer of deference on top of Chevron deference. Is when an agency looking at its own regulations somehow uniquely more rooted in their expertise, uniquely more threatening to the efficiency of the agency, such that it needs to get an extra layer of icing of deference? And for those of you thinking about that question of why not just Chevron, I'll be honest with you. If I was sadistic and writing a final exam with a theoretical question, then that obvious next question is, why even give them Chevron? Isn't this a classic Skidmore deference situation? If the agency has expertise, if the agency has deep familiarity, if the agency is charged with implementation of the statute, those are all comfortably within those four factors James described earlier. That would say, under Skidmore, you get a lot of deference. All a way of saying, our is an interesting but problematic legal doctrine. So with that in mind, let me sort of pick up the thread, because we've actually had the great advantage of already talking about power on Monday. We already, our first case for our was Gonzales v. Oregon. Remember, in that situation, the first argument thrown up by Attorney General Ashcroft was, look, this is me interpreting a DOJ regulation under the Controlled Substances Act. We don't even get to Chevron. Give me our deference. We're done. I want to go home. And the short answer there was the Supreme Court said, no. Matter of fact, they made a short shrift of the argument. The focus there was essentially that the regulation in Gonzales that was being interpreted by the Attorney General wasn't really a regulation. All people there going, wait, huh? A lot of people had the same reaction. All that regulation did was take the statutory text and repeated, virtually verbatim. So why should an interpretation of that regulation get any super deference compared to an interpretation of the statute itself, which mimics it word for word? So the court, then I have to admit, this is a kind of a one-time example. The court basically shunted it aside, didn't really get to our. Scalia, of course, objected in a dissent, said, wait, are we going to say there's not an exception to our or parroting statutes? But bottom line there is, it does come up. It was in Gonzales. We also have, however, another case that delves into it in greater detail. And here I have to say, without pausing the recording, but I think it's fair to say this, this case was rather long. I'm talking about the Florida Board of Elections case. It's interesting historically. Essentially, the Palm Beach County Canvassing Board versus Harris. I'm sure all of you remember the United States hanging on the edge of the cliff. We had an election. It was so close, it was statistically indistinguishable. And the vote for president between Bush and Gore in 2000 was down to a handful of districts in Florida. We saw very detailed discussions on whether a hanging chad or a dimple counted as a vote. This case arose out of multiple appeals up to the Supreme Court and back to try and resolve the issue. And as a result, we're not getting the final story. This is halfway through the Florida Supreme Court decision. So with that in mind, it actually has two parts I'd like y'all to think about before we start talking about it. The first part of the decision is meat and potatoes for you guys. It is straight up statutory interpretation. And as a result, it should look familiar to you. The whole discussion of may versus shall, the discussion of surplusage, the rule of surplusage, the whole discussion about the structure of the statute making sense only if you gave a maximal effort to count those. All of that is worth noting, worth refreshing your recollection with. It's not what I want to really dive into now, because the latter part of the decision goes into a separate question, which is, to what extent, actually, I just realized something. I jumped ahead, my apologies. We're now talking about constitutional issues. This is where I told you the printer meltdown on the way over here. It turns out that my speaking notes and my outline presentation, my thinking for you guys, I have every other page. So this is going to get really interesting. Okay. So back to our. Of course. I thought we missed a case. Core Alaska. And I'm surprised you guys weren't waving your hands saying, wait a minute. We read that impenetrable opinion on the jurisdiction between the Army Corps of Engineers and EPA for nothing? All right. This is the Auer case. And given the time and the fact that I've already kind of churned up the sequence here, let's jump straight into it. I'm going to go ahead and start from the middle, going left this time, so call me if you could. Give a very brief description as to what exactly was at play in the Core Alaska case.
Okay, so basically it dealt with Core Alaska wanting to reopen a gold mine, and the statute that we're concerned with had section 1344, which basically said you can't dump any kind of rock or waste into the lake, and that they should have sought a permit from the EPA. And then 1342 says that basically that this is an exception from 1344, and that they can obtain the permit from the Army Corps of Engineers.
Okay.
And so it's kind of ambiguous. And section 1316 basically says that the EPA can't grant a permit for any kind of rock pollutant. So that deals with 1344 and the fact that they have the ability to issue a permit, but 1316 bars them from issuing a permit.
Okay. So if I'll cross on this in less than a minute, but this is sort of the place that I happily dwell. What we're talking about basically is a lake. This is a side view of the lake. This is not going to get justice. This is a beautiful, pristine lake in the heart of Alaska, nestled between mountains. Water crystalline blue, alive with fish and wildlife. It has the misfortune of being near an old gold mine. As part of the process of extracting gold, the small minute flecks that are extracted through a flotation method are yielded, taken out, but then the remainder dross, the slag, the leftovers, what do you do with it? Well, it turned out that the company that wanted to do the mining just wanted to put it into the lake. Now, normally, if you or I walked out and threw something into water and it was a pollutant, we would be guilty of a violation of the Clean Water Act, which required us to go to EPA and get a permit for the discharge of pollutants to waters of the United States, not the company. The company said, we're not discharging anything. We're filling the bottom of the lake. And it turns out for dredge and fill, the Clean Water Act says the Army Corps of Engineers makes that call because that deals with the viability of our waterways to convey commerce. Remain open. If you want to fill water or fill a wetland, you go to the Army Corps of Engineers. And Colby Agley described the fact that the Clean Water Act statutorily makes that allocation of power. Now, before we go on, I'll simply say the last 10 seconds. They fill up the bottom of the lake so much that it expands area surface-wise by multiple factors. This is not a little bit at the bottom. They're actually filling up so much of the bottom that the lake is spreading out and filling the valley. They're damming the end of it so none of it gets out. And every single living organism in this lake is gone. No fish, no bugs, nothing. The water goes from milky, that's a white, a beautiful crystalline blue to a milky white. And I will show you photos, but it's pretty appalling from an environmental perspective. But we're not environmentalists here, we're lawyers. So, with that in mind, the Supreme Court gets handed this nasty statutory mess. But we're talking about this from an Howard perspective. So how does Howard play into this?
All right, so basically, Howard says, you know, if you want to look at it like a step process, you can say, step one is the interpretive rule related to an existing Chevron rule? And then step two would be, if yes, is the interpretation plainly erroneous or inconsistent with the regulation?
Right. And that is a very clear statement of the Howard rule, the Howard principle. So keep going.
All right. So they looked at it. It was ambiguous. And so they looked at the EPA's they say that Congress didn't speak on the precise question, of course. Okay, so they rely on an interpretive memorandum from the EPA. I didn't write it down on my notes.
Yep, you're exactly right. So we're not talking about a rule here. We're talking about, it's actually called, I remember right, the Regas Memorandum.
And it says, as a result, the regulatory regime applicable to discharges under Section 402, including effluent limitation guidelines standards, such as those applicable to gold or mining, do not apply to the placement of tailings into the proposed impoundment of Lower Slave Lake.
Okay, so that memo says that. What does the Supreme Court say that as a result?
So then they say that basically that the Core Alaska wins because of that memorandum. Basically that solves the ambiguity.
Because they defer basically based on this memorandum. So a couple of very good questions there. Number one, does this even pass step zero of Chevron? Would it? Does it get past me? Before you answer, let me give a little bit more outrageous detail. This is a memorandum not by EPA headquarters. This is a memorandum issued not by EPA Region 9 in Seattle. Sorry, San Francisco, Region 10 in Seattle. It's a memo issued by a sub-office within that regional office from a fairly minor level. And it's not a memo in principle. It's a memo talking about this project. Never published, no notice of comment, just tucked away into the box. Would that pass a meat test? Would that pass a smell test?
Probably just that by itself, no. All right.
And by the way, I agree with you. Take it, run with it. You know, that's 7 points right there. So with that in mind, we're saying a Regas memo that doesn't get mead, pass the mead test, not much less Chevron, is now getting super deference under Howard. Does that make sense?
It does just because they have the Chevron rule. So they meet that, and then, you know, this interpretive memorandum just really got taken to the extreme because of the Howard rule.
Okay. So it's under Howard then, it has to be not actively wrong. It's even less judicial power than a reasonable standard. So let me then finish with one other question. Bless you, by the way. I was rolling ahead. I didn't pay attention. This memo, hold it up against another very important exception to Chevron, another very important exception to Howard. Namely, the judicial branch will not give deference to litigation positions taken by the agency. And think about that. That makes perfect sense. Otherwise, the agency gets deference every time it files a brief and any time it takes a suit. This is a memo that was not written as part of this lawsuit, but everyone knew exactly, they've all worked for it, everyone knew exactly where this case was going to end up. And this memo was written specifically about this project. Why isn't this a litigation position taken in anticipation of litigation?
I think it should be. But
that's not a leading question.
We see some things later on in our other cases that do the exact same thing.
I like that. You've definitely tossed the hot potato to the other members of your reading panel now. All right. Okay. And as time grows short, I'll simply say, Colton, you captured the case. You're exactly right. This is a leading example of power deference. Essentially, a memo done by an agency. And by the way, power deference applies not just to memos, it applies to amicus briefs. It applies to letters. It applies to guidances. Interpretations, as long as the agency is interpreting its own regulation, that position under power gets extra deference. If I told you Chevron is starting to get some murmurs of discontent, power is actively under fire. And we have justices in the Supreme Court soliciting, in their opinions, cases to overturn our. So for now, take it, know it, but use it with a little bit of caution. I will simply say, keep in mind the vast bulk of agency proclamations are informal assessments of how their own regulations apply to specific circumstances. For every one regulation, you'll literally find a database of thousands of letters and determinations on how that rule applies in specific cases where people ask the agency, does this apply to me? To what extent does our apply to them? That full extended hour hasn't been tested yet. All right, so that was question number two. How does this whole framework apply when the agency is interpreting its own regulations? Let's sort of move to the next question, which is, what do you do when an agency is interpreting its own statute in a way that sends up all kinds of red flags on the constitutional front? And here, now, finally, we can get to the Palm Beach County Canvassing Board versus Harris decision and the entire meltdown, the electoral process with Bush and Gore and the Florida Supreme Court decision. And I told you the first half to two-thirds, you know it as background, and you should look at it as an example of statutory interpretation, but the risks we really want to delve into now is the latter part of the decision, where the Florida Supreme Court starts talking about constitutional concerns. And here Colton has successfully tossed the hot potato. You notice he didn't say which cases raise this, so we have to come back and pull a little bit later. But that means then, Camille, moving right to left, can you tell us a little bit about the decision and basically in particular constitutional dimensions it raises?
Okay. So I also the constitutional issue here is the right to vote.
I'm sorry, Camille, I can barely hear you, so I'm pretty sure people in other rows can't hear you either.
It's the infringement on the right to vote. So the court here is looking at whether or not the Florida statute is hurting or infringing on the fundamental principle that the electoral process and rules should be facilitating the actual citizens versus, it should be for the citizens. So that's what they're looking at.
I'm sorry, I have to tease you for a minute. When I was in law school first year, they asked me to discuss the Tallscraft case in first year torts, and I actually went the entire process of miming the scales falling on Mrs. Paul's graft and the whole thing, and use my hands, and they teased me for 3 years about talking with my hands. It's nice to see someone else who talks with her hands. So please, the gesturing, I like it, keep going. It's nice to know, but I think, given time, let's sort of skip ahead. But could I sort of make sure we get some of the details and particulars? What's the agency interpretation at issue here that we're fighting over?
Well, the agency interpretation issue is whether or not the Secretary of Florida
Can I make a nonpartisan, non-political addendum to what you just said? Secretary of State of Florida, Catherine Harris. And how many of you do you have a chance to remember Catherine Harris? A few folks are. Republican, elected statewide position, interpreted the federal election, the Florida election code to give her the authority and require her to essentially throw away ballots because they arrived too late, throw away ballots because they weren't clear because the Chad had not actually disengaged from the car. Those lawsuits were over whether or not she interpreted the Florida election code appropriately to give her that ability. So again, we're kind of getting, you know, to what extent do the facts we're talking about, the constitutional issues, color the way the court looks at her interpretation. Okay. Hopefully that was not political at first. Okay, keep going. Nicely stated, where's the constitutional dimension then?
Well, the constitutional dimension is the fundamental principle that there should not be a burden on the...
Sorry, I'm trying not to yawn because I saw someone else yawn.
Oh,
that's
my fault.
That's okay.
Sorry, I was just excited.
I've actually discovered it also works when puppies yawn at you, too. Anyway, keep going.
I'm sorry.
It wasn't you. I wasn't hiding my eyes at your answer, I promise. So... But that's where the constitutional dimension was for the opinion. And you pointed to the fundamental right to vote.
Well, they're looking at whether or not this statute will create and impose an unreasonable and unnecessary restraint on the right to vote.
Okay.
And so because these election laws should be facilitated towards or favoring the citizen, they're looking at whether or not her discretion, using her discretion to refuse the amended
But not to peck at you too much, I swear, but is there a discussion of any specific constitutional provision in the opinion? Because you're quite right, there's a fundamental right.
Article 1, Section 1, the Declaration of Rights expressly states that all political powers is inherent to the people, and therefore, since it's inherent to the people, the people, it should not be made difficult for them. Therefore, the courts can't lose sight of that purpose when they're interpreting the election laws, and so they need to see whether or not...
So just to clarify, this is the Florida Constitution.
Yes.
Okay, keep going.
Florida. And so they're looking at whether or not she is, by her refusing, or refusing that, whether or not that's lawfully exercised, and they need to see whether... that creates like penalties on the board. Like there's two ways that she could be lawfully exercised. She needs to be able to give like the reason that she would be doing that, and that reason cannot be burdening the election process. And it also states that the penalty provisions show that they're already, like the courts are already penalized because they would, if they do have like certification, there will be like fines. Also, if there is like sort of, if the Secretary of State does that, then it will disenfranchise the people able to vote, and therefore those two things make it that the court here in this case believes that the Secretary of State's discretion is infringing and is burdening the right to vote, and therefore.
Okay. So all well captured. Where's the deference?
Well, because the constitutional right to vote is the fundamental principle, that's that that's constitutional right, it should be.
So if deference to the Constitution rather than the agency? I mean, basically, did the court show any deference to Secretary of State Harris in this opinion?
Well, that they knew that these were extraordinary circumstances, and therefore they're using their equitable powers to make a remedy that would be fair.
Also, absolutely true. This case was on an unbelievable rocket. They decided in the space of days once it landed in their dock. So, anyway, keep going. Okay. All right. How many of you read this case and said, what? Why are we reading a Florida Supreme Court decision about Florida law when we're talking about Chevron, which is a federal doctrine of statutory interpretation of federal statutes by federal agencies? Red flag number one, heads up, not all states follow Chevron. Matter of fact, several states expressly reject Chevron. That's one reason why the Florida Supreme Court doesn't invoke Chevron or Auer. State court decisions, state administrative law doctrines will apply. Keep in mind, Texas has not adopted Chevron. Well, there's some discussion about how Chevron-like concepts filter through other administrative doctrines. Professor Kumar will tell you all about it in glorious detail if you take her class next year. Assuming she teaches it, I've just discovered that's up in the air. Second, you're quite right, Camille, that there's a constitutional driver that's behind this. The driver being the right to vote. And that is not only reflected in the legislature's intent behind the statute, but also the actual Florida Constitution. And while without saying it expressly, the court seems to be really going out of its way to essentially treat this as de novo review with no deference. So for those of you quietly typing away, takeaway here is that constitutional issues can result in greater scrutiny by the court, and even up to the point of bypassing Chevron deference, especially when an agency is offering its own constitutional interpretations. Having said that, does that apply to any constitutional issue? And here, I'm going to be totally honest with you, the dimensions of this remain undefined. If you're dealing with fundamental constitutional rights like the right to vote, or in particular, and we keep talking about criminal issues to extent, the right for free due process, the courts have been less deferential, even the federal courts, towards determinations by agencies that implicate constitutional rights. Now, having said that, why did the Rehnquist Court overturn the Florida Supreme Court? I mean, it seems to be a pretty dead-on, straight-up case of not deferring and reaching a decision that respects votes of the citizens of Florida. And Camille, I would normally ask you to do this, and I must apologize, but I'm a little bit worried the time's running out, and we still have one other set of cases today, which, by the way, we'll confess, it looks like that's going to bleed over to our next class. But it's our last class, and I guarantee you we'll get through everything in our last substantive class. The U.S. Supreme Court reversed because it said it's a question of federal, not state constitutional law. If you look at Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution, it invests the states with the power to identify their own electors. As a result, the only place you look to is what the legislature of the state determined was the process for identifying the electors, not the Florida Constitution, which, rather shockingly, the Supreme Court said was preempted. The state constitution was preempted by this more fundamental federal constitutional principle, and they kicked it back for further consideration, and the case kept rolled off. And as we all know how it ultimately turned out, it got back to the Supreme Court yet again, and the court ruled. And I know I keep asking this, but it's always so entertaining for me to see where you guys are in your classes. Did Professor Turner talk with you about the Bush versus Gore decision?
Yeah.
Sarah Steiger has the whole protection argument as second nature too. Right? Some of you have had others say, like, boy, did we talk about that decision. Bless you. Okay, so takeaway though, remember, constitutional issues can turn the meter on the degree of scrutiny the court's going to give, the degree of deference the court's going to give to an agency. So, with that in mind, let's turn to the next and last question. At least we can set the stage for it, which is, we've talked about power deference, we've talked about constitutional concerns. Let's talk about now preemption issues. To what extent does an agency get deference on its judgment call, its interpretation of a statute's preemptive effect? Let me give you one example and then leave you with an observation, and that will set the stage for our discussion on the Wyatt and the Finnegan cases, as well as the yet another airbag case. And we'll try and harmonize those three cases to start of our next class. But here's the thought and then the example. The thought is the exact same considerations that caused judicial reluctance in deferring to an agency's interpretation of the scope of its own jurisdiction, which Justice Scalia disposed of. Those same bootstrapping fears apply when you give the agency the power to determine when a statute preempts state law. Because a federal agency is almost always going to be benefited by saying preemption is taking effect. It means federal law becomes common law, which that agency is charged with implementing. So you would think the same dynamic of pushback by the judiciary on agency determinations of preemption would be in play. The example I want to give is a rather naked example. As part of the fight during the Bush administration over whether or not the United States was going to regulate greenhouse gases on the Clean Air Act, at one point devolved into a fight over mileage standards and whether or not certain states could demand cars be cleaner, in particular California. The Department of Transportation issued a Federal Register notice that was just one thing. It had a detailed discussion about how the agency interpreted the Constitution and the Federal Clean Air Act so that it preempted any state attempt to regulate emissions from cars or greenhouse gases. It is a clear example of an agency trying to use the process of public notice and comment in the procedural parameters to show what type of agency decision is worthy of respect to essentially lay the groundwork for a future determination in a court case as to whether preemption is taking place. Can an agency do that? Could they basically say in a Federal Register notice, this state law does not apply because we interpret the statute to preempt the field? Question number two, they did the same thing with the company memorandum interpreting their own regulations. Can they also bootstrap our super deference the same way? Have that in your mind. Review those three cases. We'll pick up with them before we start our last case, last class. Our last class is relatively light in terms of number of cases, so this would work out well. Our last reading panel has four, so we may have to have a little bit more of a group discussion. With that, last chance for any questions about extensions of Chevron doctrine to problematic areas. Or anything else? Okay. With that, everyone enjoy the weekend. Enjoy your next lecture classes. I will be available for appointments if you want to anytime Thursday and Friday, and also anytime in the next week. So sign up. All right. Thanks much.